Welcome to Wall Street Unspun with your host, Peter Schiff.
But it's a giant bubble in search of a pin, and it's going to find one.
Are you confused with the ups and downs of the economy and what it means to you?
Don't believe the propaganda, and that's what it is. When you're listening to an analyst on a lot of these popular financial shows, you're not getting investment advice. You're getting propaganda.
Get ready to untangle the web of misinformation provided by the mainstream media.
These firms are trying to sell you stocks. Their real clients, their banking clients, are trying to get rid of stuff.
And now, here's your host of Wall Street Unspun, the president of Euro Pacific Capital and a licensed broker with a passion for truth. It's Wall Street Unspun with Peter Schiff.
This is Wall Street Unspun on shortwave 5.07 megahertz. And if you haven't figured it out quite yet, this is not Peter Schiff. This is Michael Pinto. And I'm filling in for Peter tonight, who's off celebrating the Jewish New Year tonight. And Peter and I are not only friends, but I feel that we are economic soulmates. I also want to let you know that I feel he's also a brilliant economist. So I aspire to hopefully fill in for his shoes, and hopefully you won't notice such a big, wide gap. So let me tell you a little bit about myself first, for those of you who are not familiar with me. I've been a licensed broker for 19 years. I've worked on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, and I've studied economics for several decades. And before working for Euro Pacific Capital, I also worked for a boutique investment firm. But now I feel like I found my home with the Austrian audience that needs to hear the truth about economics. So before we take callers, and let me just tell you how I feel about this wonderful opportunity to be on the radio. This is your program, listeners. It's your opportunity to get something off your chest, to vent, and to ask me questions. So this is your show, so I'm going to try to talk briefly just to get you all fired up out there and maybe ping some seeds of thought and questions in your minds, and then we'll take it from there. So first, I'd like to talk a little bit about a CNBC appearance that I had just a couple of days ago. And the topic was, is U.S. debt headed for junk status? And I tried to make a cogent argument as to why I feel that, well, at least in my opinion, it's headed that way for not only junk status, but eventually default, if not an out-route restructuring of the debt, it'll be paid back in worthless dollars. But I was summarily smacked down by the host S at the time. But let me try to expound on my argument really briefly as to why I felt why U.S. was headed for a default status. And when I give my opinion about anything, I always try to use facts and figures and mathematics, because my opinion really doesn't matter if I can't back it up by data. So this is how I started, and let me pick it up from there. So the publicly traded debt, that is the portion of debt that's actually marketable out there today for the United States, is $8.9 trillion. Now, according to the OMB, the CBO, and the Treasury Department, that debt will grow. Just the publicly traded portion of it. I'm not talking about the intra-governmental debt. That's debt that we owe ourselves. The publicly traded portion of it will grow to $14 trillion by the year 2015. Now, that is nearly a 60% increase in publicly traded debt. Now, the interest on that federal debt right now, the publicly traded portion, is 5% of revenue. That's what it was last year. Now, assuming some very rosy scenarios, like 5% plus compounded annual GDP growth and very low interest rates that stay that way for the next few years, it will still, interest on the federal debt, be at least 30% of all revenue. And it's my contention that the only semblance of solvency we have as a country is because we have these artificially produced and ephemeral low interest rates. They're temporary and they're artificial. It's not going to last. Now, the U.S. dollar now constitutes about 62% of foreign exchange reserves. And that means that the U.S. bond market and the U.S. dollar is the most overowned, oversupplied, overpriced assets on the planet, in my opinion. There is a huge potential concentrated position in dollars and bonds that has to be unwound. Now, it's not being unwound now, but when it is, it's going to all rush out a very narrow exit. Now, some people might say, well, the United States deserves to be the world's reserve currency. The world should squander their savings and pile them into the U.S. dollar. But why to the degree of 62% of excess reserves? Is the United States 62% of global GDP? Hardly. It's not even 30% of global GDP. So there's a huge buildup tsunami of treasuries and dollars that has to be sold. Now, China is now a net seller. The Japanese savings rate has plummeted from 14% of personal income to 2% of personal income. So they don't have the savings yet left to squander into our bond market. Europe has their own sovereign debt crisis brewing. You look at the CDS spreads on Greek debt. They're almost as high as they were in June. So we have not seen the end of the European sovereign debt crisis. So that begs the question, who's going to buy our debt? Is it going to be Americans with their modicum of savings? And here's the better question. When will the bond vigilantes arise from their coma? I would assume someday they have to wake up and not accept an after-tax, after-inflation return that's negative. I mean, that goes against every idea of investing. So even if the U.S. remains in a recession for years to come, even if we are, quote-unquote, another Japan, eventually the supply and the inflation that comes from printing up all this money to finance our debt will send interest rates up sharply, and it will cause a severe economic trauma because of our over-indebted economy. And that's going to compel the Fed to monetize more debt, sending inflation yet higher. So that results in an inflationary debt spiral, and that's my greatest fear. That's why when I was on CNBC this week, I mean, I was talking from my heart. I was very passionate. I wasn't trying to be rude. I mean, we as Americans have to wake up now. We have to cut spending dramatically. And whatever happens, let it happen, because we cannot continue down this road. It's unsustainable. So I just have one more thing to add before we head to the phone lines, and that was about President Obama's speech that he gave today. And let me just read a very short excerpt from it. He said, some Republican leaders figured it was smart politics to sit on the sidelines and let Democrats solve the mess. Others, meaning Republicans, believed on principle that government shouldn't meddle in the markets, even when the markets were broken. Now listen to what he said. Let me read it again. Others believed, other Republicans, on principle that government shouldn't meddle in the markets, even when the markets were broken. So markets were broken? No, they weren't broken, Mr. Obama. Markets are never broken unless government breaks them. You might not like the direction markets are headed. Markets were telling you that home prices were too high and credit was too easy, and that we needed a deflationary depression to reconcile all the imbalances, albeit truncated and brief. A nice reconciling watershed event that would put everything back into balance. So the markets weren't broken. It's just that they didn't fit your political agenda. So, you know, I'm not blaming Obama for the condition of this country, because George W. Bush was no piece of cheese. I mean, he blew up the debt by 80%. So it's either, you know, a socialist or socialist light, is what we seem to be getting in the difference between Republicans and Democrats. So we have a lot of work to do in this country, and what I'm more interested in than anything is to hear what's on your mind. So let's take some phone calls. Go ahead, Paul in Florida, you are live on the air. Go ahead.
Hello, can you hear me okay?
I can barely hear you, but let's try it. Let's try to talk loud. Okay. Let's see if we can get this going. Go ahead, Paul. What's
sure.
on your mind?
Sure. I've heard Peter several times talk about that we need more manufacturing and that service jobs are the allocation that we've done. And I agree with that in general, but one of the things I did as part of an MBA project is I did talk about or wrote a paper on service export. The assumption
service
is...
Service exports. Is I'm hearing you correct, service exports, that we can be transmitted over a wire?
Well, you can't do really service exports of most services, like haircuts and lawyer services and things like that, but you can't... The two main service exports are entertainment, things like movies, and the other main thing is tourism. If a foreigner comes to Disneyland or Disney World, that's technically a service export. We provide the service inside the U.S.
Correct.
But it does get foreign money, just like we produce, say, Ford and shipped it to China.
There's nothing wrong with services. I'm the first one to say there's nothing wrong with services, but that doesn't preclude or obviate the need for a diversified manufacturing base. Because we're not spirits. We need to eat, we need to dress, we need places to live, we need commodities, we need physical things to live. And the fact is that services are a far smaller proportion of what we need to exist as human beings. So what happens is if you have only a service-based economy, then you're going to have a huge trade deficit. And if you have a huge trade deficit like we have in this country, what ends up happening is that you have a currency that's chronically weak, and you end up selling your country away piece by piece. So this is not a sustainable program for any country to undertake. You have to have a diversified manufacturing base, and you should have a diversified service sector as well. So I don't know, caller, if you wanted to make the case that we don't need any manufacturing at all, because then everything...
A major country like the U.S. certainly needs manufacturing. But I do think, I agree, we're not spirits where we can just live totally on services. But I think if you look over the last 100 years, the amount of goods we need to survive versus services is slowly going down from, you know, maybe let's say 90% to 50%. And even though the U.S. certainly needs manufacturing, you know, the economics concept of comparative advantage states, you know, maybe a small country like Trinidad or something like that might be able to totally survive on services.
Okay, but your point is that the United States can't. And
I agree, you know, that they can't, but I just don't think we should always automatically... You have to go down a level deeper when we criticize that we lost manufacturing jobs. The service jobs that maybe we gain, if they're exportable services, they're good
right.
jobs. If they're only internal services, I agree, they're bad jobs.
Right. Well, you know, that's the whole key. You know, when I rail against the fact that we lost 6.6 million manufacturing jobs since the year 2000, then what I worry about is that we're eroding our middle class. And the reason why we're eroding our middle class, I blame squarely on the Federal Reserve. They create these asset bubbles, of course, printing money from nothing, and they engender either a NASDAQ bubble or a bubble in real estate. All the jobs are concentrated in those sectors, and then what happens is all the capital, all the savings in the country goes instead of building capital goods and building the infrastructure that we need to sustain our own needs, we go into trading derivatives or we go into building houses. So it's it creates huge imbalances in the economy. And then what happens is when those bubbles pop, you end up with massive unemployment. So we're faced with a choice. We could either rebuild our middle class, and unfortunately, It means we should be rebuilding our manufacturing base, or it means we have to wait for yet another asset bubble to be generated. And I don't think anybody can, I don't think anybody would contend that the current course of just taking on asset bubble after asset bubble is the way we want to head. So that's the whole point. Do you have any other follow-up questions, Paul?
Nope. I agree with the conclusion. It's just a little tiny sub comment.
Well, I know I appreciate it. You know, if everything that if we could have a method of sending our patients who need dental work over to China, or our laundry, or our medical care over to foreign sources, then everything would be wonderful. But we can't farm out our services the way we can store and trade manufactured goods. So the bottom line is that you have to have a solid, diversified manufacturing base. Now, the U.S. is the world's number one manufacturer in dollar terms, but it doesn't change the fact that we still don't have a diversified manufacturing base, and we still have a massive trade deficit even after this credit crisis, which means we're just consuming way more than we produce, and that's completely unsustainable. But thank you very much, Paul, and I see that Tory in Illinois is back on the line, and I'd love to speak with him. Tory, are you there? Go ahead.
Yeah, can you hear me now?
I can hear you perfectly. Whatever problem there was has been resolved, and I do apologize, Tory, so go ahead.
Excellent. I'm just recently graduated from college, and I was just kind of curious of, like, what kind of jobs are good when the economy is bad, or is it just a better idea just to, get out of the country and, try another market?
Did you say leave the country and try another market?
Yeah, as opposed to U.S.
Well, for decades, this was the Mecca where if you were well educated as an Indian or if you were a Chinese engineer and you wanted the land of opportunity, you came here. You came to the United States. That's
right.
Quickly changing. More and more people are choosing to stay home because the opportunities are in foreign emerging markets. Just look at our GDP growth. We were growing at 5% in Q4 of 2009. Now we're barely growing 1.6% in Q2. I think Q3 is going to be flat, if not negative. So where's all the growth? The growth is overseas. So, I have a six-year-old son, and I want him to learn Mandarin Chinese. I want him to speak another language. I want him to be as diversified and marketable as he possibly can. Where are the opportunities in the United States? Unfortunately, as I was telling the other caller, the opportunities are to service and build asset bubbles. That is not the direction this country needs to go in. We are going in the wrong direction, and I'm afraid that we've relied too much on the fact that the U.S. dollar is the world's reserve currency. That is the only glue that is keeping everything together. Without that, if we lose that very key factor of having a U.S. dollar as the world's reserve currency, and I will hasten to add that we're doing everything we can to lose that status. I mean, why do we have a 0% interest rate on our overnight lending rate? Why are we telling our creditors that we don't care about giving them a return on their savings? Why do we have a monetary base that has doubled in the last 2 years? We are fomenting a tremendous amount of latent inflation. It's going to come out in spades in the years to come. And we're telling our creditors that we don't care about preserving the value of our currency. Once we lose that, that's when things would really start to unravel here. And that's what I fight against every day. We need to put policies in place, and we could start by raising interest rates to preserve the value of our currency. And I don't measure the value of our currency against euro or some other flawed fiat currency. Look at what the dollar has done against a real currency, real money, and that's gold. That's where you can see where the weakness, and that's how it's represented best. So do you have any other, I hope you stay in the country. I hope you sound like an intelligent man, Troy, but do you have any other follow-up questions?
Yeah, just, I guess the best way to protect yourself if you're, young, coming out of college, would maybe just to be invest in gold and maybe have to leave, right?
Well, you know, the regulators will always hasten to remind me that suitability is something I have to first determine before I mention that you should own any asset. But here at Euro Pacific Capital, we do specialize in precious metals. We do encourage international investing, especially in dividends. So, if you are interested in finding out what you should do in particular, you know, our website is www.europac.net. Our phone number is 800-727-7922. And I really would encourage you that you utilize that. And I have to apologize, too, because I haven't given the phone number to ask questions. Because if people want to ask questions, they don't know what number to call. They should call if they want to ask a question or make a comment. It's 888-678-9597. That's 888-678-9597. And I would like to ask if Rod from Illinois has anything on his mind.
Hi,
Rod,
Michael.
Rod from Illinois, you are live on the air. What's on your mind?
Well, Michael, I've been listening to Peter for a while now, and I've also been reading your commentary on the Europac website. And I noticed that both you and Peter are extremely bearish on the U.S. economy and bullish on international, but it seems like compared to the two that you're more bearish on the U.S. than you're bullish on the international. So what I'm curious about is why there isn't more talk about shorting U.S. investments, because from what I've read and what I've heard, it almost sounds like shorting U.S. investments is safer than going long on international investments.
And this is very interesting and keen. Now, I would tell you that I would probably be hauled off in handcuffs if I was on Short Wave Radio recommending people to short in mass the U.S. stock market. So I can't do that. But are there brokers at Europac that can guide you to make some appropriate short sales? I know Peter was very successful in shorting the mortgage-backed securities market back in 2006, 2007. So we do have those individual, tailored, suitable recommendations for those so interested. But you're going to have to be handled on an individual basis. So, I mean, I might engage. I was short Fannie Mae in 2007. I actually lost a little bit of money before I made some money on that trade. But we do short stocks here. But more to your other point, I guess you're alluding to the fact that going long international isn't exactly always a safe haven. Is that what you're also saying?
Yeah, I guess you could say that. Yeah, that it almost seems like if you had to compare the two, long on international versus short on U.S., it seems like based on the research that Europac has done and even in my own research, I definitely agree with you and Peter that the U.S. is going down. It's going into the crapper, and there's nothing that can stop it, where the international investments seem more like it's very probable that they're going to do well, but it seems like for sure the U.S. is going into the crapper.
Well, I think you just created live on shortwave radio, 5.07 megahertz, a very good hedge where you would short the United States and go long the international plays like, say, Australia, Singapore, Brazil, Chile, China, India. So what you're doing there, and especially if you go into the international dividends, what you're saying is that if everything is fine with the world, then these high-growth areas are going to do better than the United States. So I short the United States, but I'm going to make money on my longs international. But if everything goes down in flames, I'm going to lose a little bit of money on my international plays, but I'm going to make a whole lot of money on going short the United States. So I think you just invented a wonderful hedge. And I would encourage you to call Europac and hook yourself up with a broker and deploy that strategy, because it sounds like it could be, if it's suitable, a winning one for you.
Yeah, I actually have already spoke with a broker at Europac. I had two more, I think, probably simpler questions.
Sure, go ahead.
One of them was I've traded commodities pretty extensively in the past, and one thing that's always kind of made me scratch my head a little bit is while it seems to be quite clear why people flock to gold when things are shaky and people are nervous, people go to gold for safe haven. But silver, which hasn't really been used as a true means of exchange for buying goods for a long time, it seems like people flock to silver almost as aggressively, even though silver today is more of an industrial used right. metal than anything. So that's kind of always made me scratch my head a little bit, why silver mirrors gold so much in its moves.
Silver has lagged gold, especially in this latest credit crisis, because, as you said quite correctly, silver is an industrial metal, and it's also a semi-precious metal. So in an environment where global growth would be slowing, and in an environment where you might see a metastasizing sovereign debt crisis headed from Europe to Japan to the United States, silver would way underperform gold, because gold is real money. It doesn't really have an industrial component. And that's why I contend that gold will outperform silver, and it has, and I think it will continue to do so.
My last question is, while I agree with you and Peter on the bigger scope of things, it seems like, cutting the gravy train on unemployment and stimulus seems like that's what is needed in the bigger picture, where I fear that maybe Peter and you might be, maybe you're overlooking it or maybe you are not. I think that we have gotten, we being the country, ourselves into such deep shit that if the unemployment gets cut, and that people are literally running out of food.
What do you mean, unemployment insurance gets cut?
Yeah, in other words, that people literally cannot afford food or
right.
their essential medicines, that there's going to be riots, there's going to be crime beyond what we can even imagine, because people, if they're dying from starvation, they will be in a position where they will feel like they absolutely have nothing to lose, and I fear that... there will not be a rebuilding until there is an absolute, complete, catastrophic, violent collapse, and that the rebuilding could take decades, maybe even a century. Have you and Peter considered what a cataclysmic collapse of physical violence and rioting could happen if people are really to the point where they're starving?
Well, I mean, it's not something that hasn't happened already in the United States. It's something that has happened here. It's happened overseas. We saw a food riots in 2007 when people couldn't afford rice. So, you know, that's the tragedy of having this inflationary environment being perpetrated on the Americans. See, everybody's worried about deflation. That's the number one enemy for Ben Bernanke. He studied about the Great Depression. He's extremely worried about deflation, and he's going to do everything he can to engender inflation. I take him at his word for it, because I believe the Fed is never out of bullets, and I think they're about to start launching scuds and bombs at the American public. So, but here's the danger. Not too many people understand the pernicious nature of inflation, and I'm quite sure that Bernanke doesn't either. This is what happens. You create a lot of money. And that money, that new money that's printed, never gets evenly distributed. If it was, in theory, it wouldn't be so harmful or so deadly, because prices would go up and everybody would have more money. But that's not how it works. Money's created, it goes to a handful of people who own U.S. debt, wherever the government wants to direct it, usually to some kind of military operation. The currency collapses. The middle class only has purchasing power to afford things that are absolutely essential. Their discretionary purchasing power goes down, and jobs get lost, the economy crashes, and then if you can't afford to heat your home, if you can't afford to feed your children, you get riots. And that's what happens in every hyperinflationary economy. I hope and pray that doesn't happen here, but, you know, have we thought about it? Of course. But the best thing that you can do is prepare yourself for that. And, you know, one of the things you could do to prepare yourself for that is not having all of your assets backed by the U.S. dollar. You have to be diversified. I started the program saying that the U.S. is about 25% of global GDP. There's no reason why you should have, in my opinion, and this is, again, you have to, this is not a recommendation, broad shotgun recommendation for everybody, but you should at least look into diversifying your portfolio and having a significant portion of your assets that are in other currencies. But once again, I'd like to give out the phone number in case anybody has any questions. Thank you very much for your phone call. And if you want to ask a question or make a comment, the number is 888-678-9597. This is Michael Penta. Hopefully I'm doing a adequate job filling in for the great Peter Schiff. And I would like to know what's on John from Massachusetts' mind. What's on your mind, John?
Yeah, hi. Good evening.
Good evening. How are you?
Well, I would like for you to talk about the expansion of the M2 base and what some of the repercussions of that could be.
Okay, so why did you pick that aggregate M2? Why would you pick the base M1, M3? I'm curious as to why you picked M2. It's a good question. Why'd you pick it?
Well, the M2 is it doesn't get double counted. It's more in line with what people actually transact, isn't it?
So you're not double counting money market mutual funds. That's what you're saying, right? You're counting large time deposits, you're counting savings, you're counting demand deposits, and you're counting, physical currency outstanding. So your question is, M2 is probably up, I think, if I remember correctly, over 2% year over year. So it's a gradual increase in the money supply, yet real GDP is virtually flat, and that's why you're in a stagflation environment. So your question is, what about M2 is concerning you, the growth in it, or the lack of?
Well, I mean, I guess it ties in with fractional reserve lending and things of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
I caught a snippet of your piece with King World, Eric King.
Right.
And I'd like you to expand upon what you talked about.
Okay, wonderful.
Focused on the M2 as that was kind of like a real key thing to watch for, and I'd like you to help the listening audience to understand more where you're coming from.
Well, great question, John. So my commentary was based on the fact that people are saying that there is no inflation, we're suffering from deflation right now. So I wanted to know what they were exactly talking about. So I went through all the aggregates. I looked at the monetary base, M1, MZM, money of zero maturity, looked at the Austrian money supply, looked at M2. I couldn't find anyone that was contracting. The only thing that was contracting was M3, but as you say, there is some double counting in M3.
Right.
But if you look at what the Fed has done, okay, so this is the irony of the Federal Reserve. People say, now, if I went into my basement and I got a printing press and I printed up over a trillion dollars, nobody on this planet would say that that money wouldn't lose its purchasing power because I've diluted the currency, right? Would you say that?
Well, I do and I don't. It doesn't dilute the currency if it's not in circulation.
Okay, but if I went out and I printed $1 trillion plus, more than that, $1 trillion, and I went out and started buying stuff, or let's just say I only bought loaves of bread. That's the only thing I bought, but I bought loaves of bread. Would the price of bread go up, and would the purchasing power of my money vis-a-vis loaves of bread lose its value?
Well, the price of everything other than loaves of bread would increase as well, because you're increasing the velocity of money in circulation.
Well, okay. So you're saying that prices would increase.
So in other words, the guy who sells the bread, he's not just going to spend it on more bread. He's going to spend it on anything he wants.
Okay.
So you
okay.
just buying
so,
bread
well,
would increase the prices of everything else too.
Okay, this is a great conversation, and I want to just spend a little bit of time on this because we've got some time. I want to spend a little bit of time on this. So okay, so I printed up the money, and I bought loaves of bread with it, and the price of bread increased. Let's just assume that the person who sold me the loaves of bread just put the money in the bank and didn't buy anything. Would you at least give me that the price of bread would rise?
At his store anyway, sure.
Okay. Sure. Well, he wouldn't have $1 trillion worth of loaves of bread to sell anyway.
Yeah, but
this is what the Federal Reserve has done. They've created money by fiat, and that money has ended up as excess reserves in the commercial banking system. So people say, the Fed created money, but it all got stuck in the trees. It didn't do anything. It's fallow. It's latent. it's not doing anything. And that's only partially correct. I'm not saying it's completely incorrect. I'm saying it's definitely not totally correct. And this is why. Because the Fed doesn't just create excess reserves and put them in the, in, put them in the banking system. What they do first is they go to a primary dealer and buy something. And sometimes it's not just primary dealers. Sometimes it's any bank or financial institution. So, for instance, the Fed bought $1.25 trillion worth of mortgage-backed securities.
Right.
What happened to the price of mortgage-backed securities? The price went up, the yield went down. Now, that affected the price and the yield of MBS. That also highly influenced the cost of financing a house, and that also led to inflation, further inflation in home prices, especially given the fact that it's deflation that would have occurred had they not printed up all that money. So the fact that that this money isn't being turned over through the fractional reserve system from the money multiplier, if you look at the M2 or the M1 money multiplier, it's still relatively small, but it could blow up. So that inflation they created is, to a degree, lying latent and fallow, and could explode. And it could explode, by the way, to the tune of $30 to $40 trillion. M2 is only about $8.6 trillion. So because of the fractional reserve system, which is not 10% as most people think, it's really only about 3%. Because money that is swept into time deposits has a zero requirement. So that's a little bit arcane, but anyway, the money supply could absolutely explode given the explosion in the monetary base. But my point is, since people say the Fed can't create inflation, that's just horse hockey. Because the Fed can expand the balance sheet to an unlimited level, and they could buy anything they wanted. They don't have to just go through primary dealers. They can also go to you, and they could ask you how much IBM you want to sell. They can take in S&P futures. They can buy houses. They can buy anything they want. And they will create inflation to the point where your home is going up, your S&P stock portfolio is going up, and the money that you would think you would put back. See, I'm not a primary dealer. If I get money from the Federal Reserve, if I get a check from the Federal Reserve, I'm going to deposit in the bank. But if I'm getting 0% return on my deposit and the stock market is going up, what am I going to do with that money? I'm going to pull it out and buy more stocks. So the Fed is absolutely 100% capable of creating inflation anytime it so desires, if they're willing to go to that level in a political sense. And I believe he's going to have the green light, Bernanke is going to have the green light to do it. It's just a matter of time. He already blew up the monetary base by a factor of two. He then refused, a couple of weeks ago, he came out with a statement, he refused to let the monetary base be wound down, which I think is that's the next step. There's one more step in the process when he says, we're going to do another massive round of quantitative easing, and I believe he will. If you look at the trajectory of unemployment in this country, if you look at the trajectory of GDP, I think he's going to be forced politically to do something to save the Democrats in the fall. Look for another round of QE this late summer, early fall, and then you're going to see inflation grow even more pernicious. And I'll say this one thing, and then I'll just follow up. There is no inflation aggregate. You look at CPI, if you look at the prices paid component of ISM, there is nothing that screams deflation. We have a mild condition of inflation with very slow growth, and we're headed towards a severe case of stagflation in this country. Do you have a follow-up, John?
Well, my question to you is, in your opinion, what will be the spark that gets that velocity going?
You know, and that's another thing I want. Velocity is the turnover of money. That doesn't mean anything. If you look at the equation MV equals PQ, velocity moves with the quantity of goods. So money is a medium of exchange. If I went to you, John, and I gave you a dollar and you sold me something for a dollar, and then that dollar left my hand, now I have something, that dollar can go back and forth between me and you a zillion times. It does not create inflation because I haven't increased the supply. I can't increase prices if I haven't increased the supply of money, because then I wouldn't be able to buy anything with that same dollar. So remember, velocity moves with the quantity of goods. money supply moves with price.
Right. So, but the supply has already been increased, yet the velocity hasn't. So when do the two come into more?
No, the money supply has been increased. If you look at M1 and you look at the base, it's been increased. You're not, when you talk about velocity, you're not really talking about the turnover money as far as how many times you move a dollar bill. What you're trying to get your head around is you're trying to get your head around when will the base be turned into loans through the commercial banking system. In other words, when will I take those excess reserves? I'm a commercial bank. When will I start making loans? Well, I'm already making loans, but I'm making loans to the government. I'm not taking that $1 and turning it over and over again. See, I take a dollar, I loan it out to somebody, and then they deposit it, then I loan out the same dollar, and boom, 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 and that dollar goes around and around and around. But it's not the velocity of that dollar moving. It's how many dollars I create from that first base dollar. There's a difference. And my contention is that the debt, this is how I started the program, the debt of this country is going to grow so onerous that nobody's going to show up for our auctions one day. And within 3 to 5 years, we're going to have a failed Treasury auction. And that means interest rates spike because you have to raise the interest rate to attract buyers. But the only problem with that is that the U.S. has to roll over and to fund its deficit, it has to roll over all of the publicly traded debt each and every year. As a matter of fact, last year, the Treasury auctioned off $8.8 trillion in debt. So we're having to roll over and auction off all of our publicly traded debt each and every year. So if interest rates skyrocket, then we're insolvent. So the Fed's going to be faced with a conundrum. Do I print money to keep interest rates low? Because somebody has to service our debt. Do I do that? Or, and that's inflation, that's going to kill the economy, that's going to send interest rates eventually higher anyway. Right. Or do I do nothing, let interest rates skyrocket and have the economy collapse immediately? That's the spark that I'm fearful of. And that's what I think is going to happen in the next 3 to 5 years. I hope I'm wrong, John, but hope is not an investment process for me. I have to prepare, and that's what I'm doing. And
So what will get the banks lending again?
Well, we already are lending money to the government, and the banks aren't going to lend money unless demand is there, and consumers are already soaked in debt. Their debt as a percentage of GDP is 93%. So the demand's not going to come from new loans from the consumer. It's going to come from the government. But I really appreciate your phone call and your very insightful question. But I'd like to go to Ed in Florida. Ed, what's on your mind, my friend?
Hey, how you doing, Mike?
Good, good. Good to hear from you.
Hey,
and
I used
to live in Florida for 4 years, and I love it and miss it. And how are you feeling, Ed? What's on
I'm
your mind?
I'm doing great. I never watch CNBC anymore. To me, it's just Hollywood. But I did see Peter's blog, and so I did tune in and watch it on the Internet. And I thought, you know, I even sent a comment to CNBC. I thought Erin Burnett was... I thought she was rude, extremely rude. I thought you were passionate. I just thought I'd say that. So that's from my point of view.
So
I'm
thank
a client,
you.
Maybe
I'm biased. That.
I
appreciate that.
That
you know, there's no plural form of you in the United States English language. So when I said you, Aaron, have to explain to me why the bond market will always display low interest rates, I didn't really mean, you know, her particularly. I meant the market in general, but go ahead.
Yeah,
I appreciate your thought, Ed. Do you have a question?
Yeah, my question, can you hear me?
I can hear you perfectly now.
Yeah, okay. I don't understand all the nuances of M1, M2, and M3 and whatever, and the velocity of the money situation, but I do know that this country is very, very good at starting wars, and what are your thoughts? We know that the United States' its currency is the world's reserve currency. And this backs against the wall. They start something with Iran, which is already, to me, as far as I'm concerned, they're trying to get it going. I mean, every time
who
you turn the news on...
Are you talking about... when you say they, are you saying the United States?
I'm talking about the United States starting a war with Iran, some kind of a war, whether it's limited or whatever. But since oil is priced in dollars, isn't that a way to prop up the dollar? Because, you know, if they block the Straits of Hormuz, that could make the... I mean, I don't know how long it would work, but that's to me, it would not surprise me if they did that, to keep the dollar from collapsing.
Well, you know, yeah, I mean, that's sort of Machiavellian. I'm not, you know, I can't really speak to conspiracy theories. I hope and pray that's not the case. But I don't think we need, I don't think we need anything else to send the dollar lower other than our own actions. And I don't think even a war that would send oil would go to $200 a barrel, in my opinion, overnight if the Strait of Hormuz was blocked. But I mean, I even think that in and of itself will still not save the currency or the country, because, you know, if you look at how much oil we import, over, I mean, our trade deficit would absolutely explode if we had a situation where oil spiked to $200 a barrel. And you know, I think the dollar would fall even further because of our trade deficit. And so if that's what this country is planning as a panacea, I would submit to them they should go back to the drawing board. But thank you for the phone call, and okay. I think I'll jump to Al in South Carolina. Al, what's on your mind?
Mike, can you hear me?
I can. I apologize for the beginning of the show. I don't know what went wrong, but whatever happened, the producers have fixed it, and you're coming in loud and clear. So what's on your mind, Al?
Well, first off, Mike, I hope you can keep my money real. Because I used to listen to you on Delta Global, your little weekly thing. It was a pleasure. You and Peter, I always really listen to separately. It's great that you're over here with Euro Pacific. And
well, Peter's my soulmate. I'm happily married, but I can't marry Peter. But he is my economic soulmate, so I'm happy we found each other too. But what's on your mind, Al?
I have arguments with people about inflation in China. And one of the things that I say to people is, you better hope there's not an inflation in China, because if the Chinese are losing purchasing power and they can't afford food, the first thing that's going to happen, and I'm asking you this, wouldn't the Chinese take some of their reserves, their U.S. dollar reserves, and start buying the RMB and contracting the money supply and deflating their currency, which at the same time would inflate our currency and cause a tremendous inflation here?
Well, you know, you can't abdicate your own monetary policy unless you let somebody else do it. Now, the Chinese have the luxury, because they have such tremendous U.S. dollar reserves, they can actually stop their currency from sliding. But you know what? I'm more concerned about the fact that the Japanese have decided that what they want to do is to keep their currency very, very weak vis-a-vis the U.S. dollar. I'm also very much concerned that this country believes that we can rescue our manufacturing base by depreciating the U.S. dollar. So, you know, when you have the printing press, you always, always can reduce your country, your country's purchasing power vis-a-vis another country. But it's very difficult to raise the value of your currency. The only way you can do that is by having currency reserves, and that's something that's a luxury of the Chinese. That's something that's a luxury of the Japanese. It is not a luxury of the United States. So I'll give you a chance to ask another follow-up question, Al.
Yeah, good. Thanks, Mike, because there's one thing that I'm really concerned about. I'm kind of heavily invested in the metals, silver, gold miners, silver miners, oil, Canadian oil. I got an account with Euro Pacific. One of the things that you mentioned earlier in the show, if the Republicans should get in and they start raising interest rates, is that going to be a signal that I have to really hurry up and, you know, change my philosophy and get out of all these stocks?
Well, okay. So here's the thing, you know, gold prospers, precious metals prosper in an inflationary environment. Everybody says that gold does really well in a deflationary environment. I don't quite get that. If the administration came out and said that we are going to slash spending dramatically and lower the budget deficit and the amount of debt outstanding in the United States, and simultaneously came up with a plan to raise interest rates to offer a real positive rate of return on investor savings. In other words, if gold was faced with those headwinds, it would plummet. It wouldn't fall. It would plummet in value.
Yeah.
See, I'm
yeah.
a very objective person. I'm not trying to sell you something because, you know, here at Euro Pacific Capital, we have a lot of freedom to do anything we want. We don't have an agenda to portray on the American people. We can switch, you know, if the administration does something right, then we're going to recommend that you balance your portfolio accordingly. So we're not Johnny One Notes. We're not stop clocks. So if gold was faced with those headwinds, yeah, I mean, I would be very concerned. But the fact of the matter is, even if they did, even if they came out with that scenario where they said we're going to raise interest rates, a positive return on investment, and we're going to stop spending, you still would have a very short, abbreviated, truncated economic collapse, which would still be more supportive to gold than it would be any other asset class, in my opinion, besides maybe short-term treasuries. So, I feel very comfortable. Of course, this is not a recommendation, a blanket recommendation. Again, I want to make sure I fulfill my obligation to FINRA and the SEC. I'm not making a blanket recommendation. I'm just saying I'm very comfortable with the gold position here at Europac. I don't think the United States has the political will to cut spending. I don't think they have the political will to raise interest rates. I think gold could suffer if they did. It would drop in price precipitously, as I say. But compared to the other investments, at least in the short term, it would still have a positive outperformance, in my opinion.
Gotcha. I got it. Hey, Mr. Pinto, hey, I want to tell you one thing. I used to really be disappointed when Peter wasn't on the air, but now that you're around, I'm hoping you're going to be on quite a bit.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Al.
I'm on
Peter's behest, and I work for him, but I really appreciate your comment. And I would love to grab, if we could, Jeff in New York. Jeff, what is on your mind? Make a comment.
Hey.
Ask a question. The floor is yours.
Hey, Mr. Pinto, thanks for taking my call, and nice to have you on the show.
Thank you, Andrew. Thanks for saying so.
My question is, how do you expect the market to react initially once we see prices going up? I mean,
how do I expect the market to react? What market and what prices?
I mean, once inflation really sets in, once prices start to go up, gas line goes up, groceries goes up, what will the Dow Jones do? Will the Dow Jones go up as a result?
Well, it all depends. Now, this is a very interesting question. Jeff, this is a brilliant question on your part. Is inflation good for equities or is it bad for equities? The answer is how much inflation. If you have a little bit of inflation or a moderate amount of inflation, you can expect a nominal return, a small return in stock values. However, they will not be of the real variety, and that means they'll underperform inflation, but they'll go up a little bit. Now, if you have hyperinflation, if you look at all the hyperinflationary economies, if you look at Weimar Germany, if you look at Argentina, if you look at Bosnia, Georgia, anytime you've had hyperinflation, the stock market goes up in nominal terms, but gets wiped out in real terms. So this is the danger. This is the danger in shorting a market. You know, if you thought you could just make money shorting the U.S. stock market and you can just, you know, place your shorts and go to sleep, I'd be very, very cautious of that because, you know, Ben Bernanke can come on television at any moment and say, I'm monetizing the long end of the Treasury curve. I'm buying $1 trillion of 10-year notes in the next year. And what do you think would happen to interest rates in the short term? Well,
probably
I think they would fall in the short term, in the very short term. What would happen to the value of equities if Bernanke came out with it? Well, the dollar would get wiped out in value. So the dollar's purchasing power would go down, not just against it would go down especially against hard assets, but it would lose its value even as measured against homes and against equity prices. So, you know.
Yeah. This is the tricky part. It's hard to tell how to react given the situation that we have and given that we don't know what the Federal Reserve is going to be doing. I wonder how to preserve my savings, and I don't really have an answer to that.
Well, you see, everybody. You know, this is the problem that people are facing right now. They've been so burned by the Nasdaq blow up, then they were burned in real estate. Then you have the flash crash. You have Bernie Madoff. The market has gone nowhere in 12 years. And in nominal terms, it's gone nowhere. In real terms, it's been destroyed. If you measure it against the dollar, it's down 40%. If you measure it against gold, it's down 80%. So people are very afraid right now, and they're just what are they doing? They're just plowing all their savings into the treasury market, and here's what they're saying: I know I cannot lose. I absolutely cannot lose any principal if I purchase treasuries. And that's what I hope, Jeff, that before doing that, you at least consult with a Europac a consultant.
I definitely won't do that.
I won't
do that because I certainly know what the effects of inflation are. It's just remarkable to me that we don't see an increase in prices, at least not high as we would expect it.
Jeff, go look at what the cost of commodities have done recently. Go look at the cost of education, medical supplies. Their prices are soaring in these other places. You know, this is a quick comment. I think we have time to make this comment. If you look at the CPI calculation, 40% of the core calculation is owner's equivalent rent. 25% of the overall CPI is owner's equivalent rent. So since the housing market just exited a bubble, it's the last to respond to this renewed monetary stimulus. So,
right.
So you, if you take out, you know, 40% of the core is going to be stagnant or falling in price, then you're not going to get the huge readings on CPI. But year-over-year CPI, it's not negative. It's still up over 1%. PPI is up 4%. Producer prices are up over 4%. ISM prices paid component was soaring. So, you know, this idea, this illusion, you know, it's only the Federal Reserve could have done this. The Federal Reserve has convinced the public that the price of oil at $75 a barrel is deflationary. I mean, for decades, it was $20 a barrel. Just because it went to 147 and it's dropped to 75, I mean, is that deflation? That's not deflation at all. That's just a temporary reprieve from the all-time highs in oil. And I'm afraid that you are going to completely wipe out the purchasing power of the middle class if we unleash all of that latent inflation that's sitting there at the Federal Reserve. It's called commercial banks deposits at the Federal Reserve. It's sitting there laying fallow, at least temporary. And when it's released, you're going to see a massive increase in prices. And and by that time, by the way, it'll be too late.
To happen. If you have any clue when you think we will see that kind of inflation happening?
Well, I mean, like if I knew that, you know where I would be. But I would probably be right here talking to you. I would guess 3 to 5 years, but that's just a guess. But you know, thank you very much for the phone call, Jeff. Let me just have an opportunity. I have 30 seconds left. I want to thank Peter for the opportunity for sitting in. Here I'm on Wall Street Unspun. Please, the website is www.europac.net, and the number to call if you want to speak to one of our representatives is 800-727-7922. Thank you very much. God bless you. Happy New Year, and talk to you soon.